Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Soundbites. Should farmers be allowed to not comply with new laws pertaining to nutrient management for the next 10 years? And should farmers and lawn companies have to list every chemical and pesticide they use on the land? Well, that's what the Ag Certainty Bill and the Pesticide Information Act, respectively, would do if they passed through the General Assembly in Annapolis. And we'll be debating those ideas during the course of this episode of Soundbites. One way or the other, both acts could have serious consequences for our region and for the health of the Bay and our people. And then, another tantalizing recipe, this time a great Palestinian Easter recipe from Lalia El Haddad that you won't want to miss. But first, we talk with Tim Wheeler, writer of Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's blog on the environment and agricultural news. One of the things he's been writing about is the Ag Certainty Bill, a controversial piece of legislation that some say would lead to a pollution pass for Maryland farmers for the next 10 years, and others say would provide relief for farmers while giving impetus to comply with existing laws. So, Ag Certainty, or as I mistakenly called it to you a little while ago, Ag Uncertainty. So, to talk a bit about what this bill is. I mean, because when I first heard the bill, I wasn't sure what it meant.
Well, it's gone by other names. Safe Harbor was another sort of the concept that was bandied about. It's been sort of perking along under the surface here for a couple years, been talked about. This bill was introduced relatively late in the session, but the proponents said that's because they were trying to work out the details of this and get it in shape to move forward. It actually passed the Senate yesterday with a very sizable majority and no real debate. The concept of the bill is essentially, according to the proponents, to get farmers to voluntarily step up, the voluntary program, to step up and do things on their farms to reduce runoff of nitrogen and phosphorus and sediment, the things that are causing the Bay water quality problems, to go beyond, you know, what is necessarily required right now of farmers. And if they did that, according to the proponents, and the way the bill's structured, they would basically get a 10-year buy or a deferral on having to comply with any new regulations or laws that might, you know, put obligations on them to reduce runoff for a period of up to 10 years. At the end of that 10 years, if the laws have been changed, if, you know, new requirements are put on farmers, they'd have to catch up with those and meet them.
I mean, it's interesting that the environmental organizations themselves are split. Chesapeake Bay Foundation supports this bill, but everybody from the Sierra Club, Man Clean Water, and many others are opposed to this bill.
Yeah, it's a fairly lopsided split, actually. The Bay Foundation appears to stand alone as the only environmental group that supports it. The Chesapeake Bay Commission, which is made up of legislators and administration folks and some citizens, also supports it. The Farm Bureau, as you imagine, is in favor of it. The lion's share, virtually every other environmental group that's out there, has voiced opposition to it, or at least said they believe it needs more time to work out the details to address concerns they have. Their complaints are several. Someone, just on the policy level, they think it's a bad idea to give any sector a pass on, you know, meeting regulations, even a temporary one. This is a deferral, I guess is what the proponents like to call it. The other issue that they have a concern with is something that's sort of been built into Maryland law already, which is that the farmers who enter into this program, in order to qualify, their identity would not be revealed to the public. So it would not be fully transparent on that level. As you know, the nutrient management plans, which are one of the things that every farm in Maryland is required to have now, are essentially not public documents, at least in the way that you could identify a plan with a particular farm. You can get the data, but with the names removed. And one of the concerns also is that if you lock these farms in for 10 years, if, as we go down the road here, another 4 years from now, the Chesapeake Bay restoration effort that EPA is directing, they're going to be doing essentially a mid-course correction in terms of what everybody might have to do to clean up the bay. There's some question about how many farmers would actually participate in this program or would qualify.
Why is that?
Well, it does require more jumping through hoops. You have to get inspected every 3 years, which is about three times more often than the state inspects farms now. And you have to provide a lot of data to the state. The state will publish the data or compile it, so without the names attached. And there is this commitment to doing not just what is currently required by law, but also to doing on your farm things that would basically reduce your runoff, which is not now currently regulated. The Clean Water Act does not regulate agricultural stormwater runoff.
When you look at this uncertainty bill, I mean, for you, just very quickly, what are the most kind of positive or negative implications of the bill?
I'm still trying to learn and learning about what it would mean, and I think even the proponents admit they're not sure how many farms would participate in this. There are some belief that only a couple dozen or a few dozen would sign up to begin with. There are those who think that if indeed there is a major mid-course correction required to clean up the bay in 4 years or so, that a lot of farmers would see the benefit of getting locked into this program before that happens, so they could put it off for another 9 or 10 years. And that could pose some issues for meeting our 2025 deadline for having everything in place in order to clean up the bay. You know, there's some uncertainty there, I think. Everything in life, I suppose, is uncertain to a degree, so it's a question of how comfortable you are with it. I'm, you know, as a journalist, I like to be able to see and know everything. And I'm a nosy guy, so being able to know what's happening on a particular piece of property is, you know, something that puzzles me, and I'm always troubled about not knowing that kind of detail.
I mean, I wonder if some of the fuel for saying that farmers' identities and where their farm locations are would be classified, for want of a better word, would not be public information. If that was kind of fueled in some senses by the Hudson trial, the Purdue-Hudson trial, and that was kind of gave it more weight.
Well, that's certainly been the argument that the farm community has used for, you know, defending the lack of, you know, releasing names relative to nutrient management plans and their aversion to having the public know their business. They point to the Hudson case and say, see, these, you know, environmental groups are just, you know, waiting there to pounce on somebody and to sue them. And you know, nobody has specifically cited that to me yet, but I think that's maybe at least one reason why they want to extend it to this, too. They're providing more information about their farms than you simply do with a nutrient management plan. Farms that are regulated with permits under the EPA's CAFO program, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations, are not eligible to participate in this because they, by law, by federal law, have to be basically, everything has to be public about them. So they will still remain open and transparent, and they will not be able to qualify for this certainty thing, because if EPA changes the requirements for CAFOs, then they would have to comply promptly.
Well, this is fascinating. And Tim Wheeler, I hope you'll join us again the next couple of days. We want to talk some more about some of the issues, especially wind power, which we'll be covering here on the show. I'd love to have you join us for that. And I want to thank you once again for being part of this program.
My pleasure.
That was Tim Wheeler, writer for Be More Green and reporter on environmental and agricultural news for the Baltimore Sun. Now, the Ag Certainty Bill has our region's environmental groups split. Many have expressed their opposition for the bill, while others have come down in support of the provisions. And to get a sense of this divide, we talk with Kim Coble, Vice President for Environmental Protection and Restoration at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, and Josh Tolkien, State Director for the Sierra Club Maryland Chapter.
Well, first of all, I think there's a lot that Josh and I agree about. And I think that's important to note, that ultimately what we're trying to do is reduce pollution from agriculture, reducing pollution going into the bays, the rivers, the streams from agriculture. And the question is, what's the best way to get there? What we like about the what's called the Ag Certainty Program is that for the first time, we'll have farmers implementing pollution-reducing practices ahead of schedule and at a level that will assure that the what's called the TMDL, but basically the pollution limits that we have to achieve in 2025 are being met now. So we have accelerated pollution reduction practices on farms, And in the trade-off of doing that, the farmer is given 10 years to implement any new laws that might come down the pike in that time period. So we have accelerated pollution reduction practices. We have access to information about those farms in a way that we've never had before. We're focusing the department's very limited resources, Department of Agriculture's limited resources, on farmers that aren't doing anything or doing very little, and we're getting the pollution reduction. So we feel that all of that is value-added and good for the bay and the rivers and streams.
And Josh, I'm curious where this split comes from and why so many environmental groups are opposing this bill.
Well, thank you. And we do agree on a lot of points with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, and Kim and I have worked a lot in the past together. But in this particular case, we do disagree, and we believe that this proposal is unfair and short-sighted and poses a serious threat to the bay. And the reason is as follows. 10 years of exemption from pollution is enormous, and it's risky. We run the risk of actually having the agriculture sector exempted at a time when we need to make critical adjustments to our Chesapeake Bay restoration efforts. No other source of the Chesapeake Bay pollution is granted a similar immunity. And every other sector, from taxpayers who are now contributing to a double flush fee to wastewater treatment plants and owners of septic systems, are all being asked to make similar efforts without being offered this same certainty. And we think that each sector should do its part.
Why, I'm curious from both your perspectives, Kim and Josh, why should or should not the agricultural system in Maryland, the farms, be exempted when others are not?
Well, I guess I'd like to address that because the way we read the bill is that a farmer is not exempted by any means. The way the TMDL and the watershed plans, what the state's obligations are, is that by 2025, each state has to reduce the amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment pollution going into the bay, or EPA will take actions against them. So the states are working very diligently to get the pollution reduction from all sources, from wastewater treatment plants, from stormwater, from homeowners, and from farmers. So what this bill says is that if you're a farmer, Mark, and you right now put everything on your farm that you will need to have by 2025, if you do that right now, so you're doing it, you know, 13 years ahead or 12 years ahead of schedule, we're going to give you some flexibility over the next 10 years on implementing any future recommendations or requirements that might come down the pike. So they're not exempted or immune. In fact, they're being accelerated to meet reductions. That's how we read the bill. And the other point I'd like to make is that there's a permitting program that's called a National Pollutant Discharge Permit, an NPDES. And this permit applies to wastewater treatment plants. It applies to municipalities. There's also another type of a permit called a general permit. And these permits are 5 years long. And during that time period, the permittee is granted the same thing that these farmers are being granted. They don't have to meet anything new. They just have to meet whatever their permit is stating. And actually, these permits nationally, on average, are about 7 to 8 years long. So this is very consistent with what's being done in the permitted world as well.
I think most people listening to this, in some ways, Josh, are confused. I mean, if the accelerated thing means that more things are done for the bay by farmers, but how does that balance out with the exemption?
Well, first, I think that there's several very critical differences between this certainty program and a permit. A permit is transparent to the public. A permit is a publicly accessible document that has specific reduction amounts that any citizen, any public organization, any individual can get access that to understand what's going on. University of Maryland will have access that to actually assess our progress on these permits, as Kim discussed. Secondly, it's not correct to say that a permit provides 5 years of exemption. A permit can be petitioned to be reopened. So if there's a major change in law, a petition can actually be changed. But more importantly, a permit doesn't exempt you from other laws. And I think that's the critical difference here. This would actually exempt a farm from other policies that are coming online, which would apply to other farms or agricultural operations. And that's really the critical point. But I think where Kim and I might fundamentally disagree is I think she's presenting a notion that we have everything figured out in the agriculture sector, and these farms are just coming online to this 2025 goal early. We disagree. We don't think we have a solid plan on how to reduce pollution from the agriculture sector. I think that lots of questions have emerged about whether or not the policies that are in place are working and whether or not they're being followed. But more importantly, there isn't a farm-by-farm policy that's supposed to get us to our goal in 2025. So we don't actually know what it is that each farm is going to have to do. And in a recent hearing, Buddy Hance, the Secretary of Agriculture, actually said that these plans that they would be required to follow, two different people could come up with two different plans that of what a farm is supposed to actually do to qualify. So this feels like a very ambiguous turf to be offering someone certainty for 10 years when we're not really even clear what we're asking them to do.
Let's say we look at what's going on with the Pesticide Information Act, that's being tabled to a working group. It looks as if that's going to happen, as opposed to any implementation. But if that, in fact, became a law, and the farmers and others were forced to kind of delineate just what they use, how much they use, where it goes, where they got it, et cetera, that would mean under this new law that those farmers who cooperated with the law and accelerated, as you said, Kim Kobel, would be exempt from this, right?
No.
Why?
Because the flexibility applies only to programs that pertain to nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment. So it's a limited scope on what a farmer would be, where they would have flexibility in implementing it. It's not every law across the board. It's limited to just nutrient pollution.
So if we know, though, that nutrient pollution is one of the biggest problems we face when it comes to our waterways, the health of our waterways and our land, and we also know that it's not all coming from Maryland farms. A lot of it comes upstream from Pennsylvania. Then why do we need this law? What does this law do for I mean, given that what I've read, maybe you can correct me, Kim, but what I've read is that a third of all farms are out of compliance anyway. So what does this law really do?
Yeah, it's a good question, so I think that actually you're hitting the nail on the head, Mark, because Josh is right. This industry is less understood than probably any other industry, any permitted industry. But agriculture is not permitted. That's the Clean Water Act doesn't allow it to be permitted as the same way as a wastewater treatment plant. So we're limited on what access we can have to a farm and to the information on a farm. What this bill does, though, is it accelerates implementation of the practices we know that work. You know, in the meantime, a farm can continue as it's going, and as long as the state is meeting reductions by 2025, that's the measurement we have. And so this way, we're getting farmers that want to do good things earlier. We're saying, yes, please come on board. Please do these things earlier. And in lieu, we'll give you some flexibility on when you have to meet other nutrient-pertaining laws. And it's sort of like a bird in the hand versus, you know, someday hopefully getting some kind of a permitting program for farmers, which is a long way off, if ever. And we feel that the short-term gain that we would have over these farms doing accelerated programs is really worth it.
And what is the opposition to this, Josh, worried about? What are the new, quote-unquote, nutrient-pertaining laws that you think could come into effect that would be really detrimental to the environment and to other things if farms were exempt for 10 years?
That's a great question. Let me touch on one other thing real quick. You mentioned the pesticide law. I think that's a great example of the public's desire for transparency. And in that case, the public wants to know what pesticides are being used. They do not have access to the same information on what a farm is doing with nitrogen and phosphorus and fertilizers and other nutrients that they may be putting on their farm. It's just critical to note that without that information, we believe it's very hard for us to assess if we are making that progress. And it's very hard for the public that's being asked to take on a financial burden for them to have faith in the program if so little information is known. And that's not a federal law. That's a very specific state policy that is actually written into this bill saying that information to the public will be limited. But I would put the question back to Kim about the policies. If the agriculture sector is already on track, then there wouldn't be any future change in policies. So what exactly do you think that the agriculture sector might want exemption from? What are these regulations that we may actually need to get the agriculture sector on track? Because our concern is, if we're already on track, then there shouldn't be new regulation. Then what are people so concerned about needing certainty from?
Kim?
I can't speak for the farmers. Our perspective is that we're trying to ensure that nutrient pollution is not going into the bay from any source. And we see a program here that would help us reduce nutrient pollution in the bay faster than without having it. And so that's why we support this. There's 12,000 farms in Maryland, and this program, we all agree, including the agricultural community, is very, very slim and or small in scope. That these are the A-plus farmers. These are the guys and the gals that want to do the right thing and want to do it well. And so our sense is that if we can give them any incentive to speed up the good practices, then let's give it to them. And I think Josh and I agree on this, is that, and then let's focus on those farmers that are not interested in doing the good things, on the bad actors or those that aren't putting in practices. Let's go ahead and let the state focus on those. So, you know, we can put the A-plus students aside. We can focus on those that aren't passing, that aren't doing good work, and get them to get up to speed. We just feel like it's a real win-win for the farming community, the Bay, and for all of us.
When we looked at the Maryland the Pesticide Information Act, it was clear who pushed that bill, which was the Maryland Pesticide Network and others who were doing research around the growth of neurological disorders and ADHD and childhood diseases and cancers, that want to be able to track the pesticides to see where they're coming from, to have some firm scientific ground to stand on if there is some. And it was clear who was opposed to it. And we interviewed the industry representatives who were opposed to it. So, but I'm curious, Josh and Kim, who was pushing this bill? I mean, who are the political forces and organizations that are kind of want this bill to take place? Josh,
I could tell you more about the opposition than I could about the proponents. Well, what I can tell you, if you'd like me to answer that,
hey,
is
sure.
there are 23 organizations that are currently opposed this legislation. It includes the National Wildlife Federation, the League of Conservation Voters, and obviously the Sierra Club. And Kim is right. We've got a lot to focus on the agriculture sector, and there are some farms out there that are doing great work. But fundamentally, if there is no transparency, then we believe that it lacks accountability. We need to be able to understand and verify what's going on. And while I appreciate that this bill may give the Department of Agriculture access to more information, until we, the public, have access to it, we don't have confidence in exactly what is being implemented, and more importantly, whether it's reaching the desired goal. And I think if we're going to be asking farmers to be taking on these regulations, to be taking more steps, we should be verifying that they're actually leading to the desired reductions. And if we don't know that, then we think we have to stop investing in a broken system and focus on the big picture. So is this bill the worst thing in the world? No, but it distracts us from the more important topic of verifying and understanding what's actually going on in the agriculture sector.
And very quickly, Kim, what about the issue of transparency? And why is that important?
Yeah, it's a good point. And we, too, agree that transparency and verification are key. That's one reason that we have built into the bill unprecedented transparency and verification for the agricultural community, including third-party verifiers that would go onto farms, randomly selected, would go onto farms every 3 years and verify that practices are being in place. Nothing like that is occurring right now. It would also allow both MDA, MDE to go onto farms at any given time and make sure the practices are being put in place. Nothing like that going on currently. It also gives data that the third-party verifiers collect on farms about application of fertilizers, soil test results, practices and where they're being done, how they're being done, and this would be aggregated to the watershed level. Nothing like that is going on currently. So is it full transparency as is under a permitting program? No. Is it moving the ball forward on verification, transparency, pollution reduction? Absolutely.
My only thought that I want to add at the end is I think the critical thing here to understand is that this is not about the individual farmers. It is not about trusting or not trusting individual farmers who have a history of being stewards of the land and a strong history in Maryland. It's about public access to information. If there's one thing that I'm sure that Kim and I agree on, it's that we need to be finding ways to work with and strategize and support farmers in Chesapeake Bay pollution.
Thank you, Kim Coble, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, and Josh Tolkien from Sierra Club Maryland Chapter. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. Up next, we talk with two delegates about the Pesticide Information Act, which would require commercial pesticide applicators and farmers to report information about the chemicals they use on lawns and on their land. And then we'll also hear a recipe just in time for Easter from Lelia El Haddad, author of the book Gaza Kitchen. Delicious. Don't go away.
Hi, I'm Sandy Rosenberg, member of the House of Delegates. Public debate, consideration of the issues, that's what Mark's been about for the last 20 years.
Join the Center for Emerging Media Board as they honor Mark Steiner for his 20 years on the air and 50 years working for justice. April 6th at ABAM. More information at steinershow.org/2050. Champion sponsors, the Osprey Foundation and Clean Cuts, Cerebral Lounge, media partners, the Baltimore Business Journal, and WEAA-FM.
Welcome back. We turn our attention now to the Pesticide Information Act, a bill that will require farmers and pesticide applicators to submit information about the pesticides and chemicals they use on lawns and their lands to the State Department of Agriculture. Kathleen M. Vitale, a delegate for District 33A in Anne Arundel County, and Stephen Lafferty, delegate for District 42 in Baltimore County, join us to talk about what's happening with the bill in Annapolis and where they stand on this controversial piece of legislation. So, Delegate Lafferty, you were one of the sponsors of this bill. Take us back a bit, remind our listeners about what this bill is and why you introduced it in the first place, or one of the folks who introduced this bill. What was it saying?
I think everybody in polling has clearly shown that people are very concerned about pesticides and the impact that pesticides have on not only the environment but on public health, and specifically as it applies to children. For a number of years, there's been conversations about how do we gather adequate data in the state so that researchers, scientists can take a closer look geographically at the impact of pesticide application, as well as then personally. Previous efforts have not been successful. This year, I introduced the bill that would require those who are professional and commercial applicators to report the data back to the Department of Agriculture. Currently, they are required to maintain records, maintain data after each application, indicate which chemicals have been applied, wind speed even. And this would apply to commercial applicators in commercial and residential settings, as well as to the farming community. I think it's important that we have a centralized source of information so that we can better understand what the impact may be.
This applies only to commercial applicators and farmers, right?
Correct. Well, anybody who would be certified or registered with the Department of Agriculture. So it would not apply to the individual homeowner who goes out and buys a product for application at his or her home.
And so, Delegate Vitale, talk about your opposition to it and what the opposition is saying.
Well, I think the opposition comes from two different directions. First of all, as we know, on the Eastern Shore, the Hudson family took quite a hit on a recent lawsuit. Although they were the prevailing party at the end, they found themselves for years embroiled in litigation because somebody decided they saw something on their property that turned out not to be what they thought. Going through that process, however, $1 million later, as I recall, in terms of litigation fees, almost devastated that farm. So on the Eastern Shore, at least, people are very hammer shy, if you will, on anything that would require a reporting of what is being done that could be collected and utilized by a group or an organization to target any particular farm or agricultural property owner.
And the bill, as we put forward, would avoid some of that. We certainly do not want to expose any individual property owner or applicator to being pursued. The bill bill as I proposed it would have required reporting by watershed and or by zip code or some other formula that the Department of Agriculture felt was appropriate so we could protect the privacy of the individuals. We're certainly not trying to create witch hunts or in any respect trying to set people up for litigation.
And certainly the delegate might have had a chance to talk a little bit about that, and I believe that his intentions were exactly as he just said. There was a goal, if you will, of understanding what was happening within a watershed. The problem becomes that, as I'm sure you know, as a government organization, any collection of that data by very definition becomes subject to Public Information Act. And it was, because the original bill was put forth, it became very obvious that it was impossible to protect, you know, that information from being received by whether it was an organization or a group or a particular citizen that could then later be used in litigation. And the ability to obtain information through the public information access and then to say, oh, now that we have this information, we're not going to use it with a wink and a nod, was very disturbing. And I certainly had an opportunity to take a look before we started today in some of the communications that we had gotten from citizens on the shore as well as citizens on the Western Shore about that concern. The bill, obviously, as I'm sure the delegate will explain, has gone through quite a transformation at this point. The other part was that there were some reporting requirements that involved certain identifier numbers and information that nobody seemed to know whether it was the user or the Department of Ag, how to actually obtain the information that was being sought in the legislation. So the bill saw a transformation from a reporting and information to a work group to look into a better way to do this.
Delegate Lafferty, so I mean, just for clarity from both of you, just to figure out where it stood or stands. I mean, so the bill is now dormant, correct? It's not coming to the floor?
No, actually, we voted it out yesterday on third reader, but it came out, as Delegate Vitale just said, as a work group. It was clear, as the delegate pointed out, there were quite a lot of differences of opinion between the applicators, the farm community, the environmental community, over what might be the best way to proceed, and we weren't really able to resolve a lot of those conflicts during the session, so there was agreement along with the department to create a work group that will convene after the session and try to get people to sit at the same table and have conversation about how this might proceed. Certainly, maintaining as much privacy as possible is one of the charges of the study commission, let alone what might be the research gaps, what agencies currently see may be the gaps in data, because DHMH is concerned about the public health, obviously, natural resources, the environment, and agriculture, all concerned about impact on the lands and the waters as well as air quality. We now have a study, at least, that's been agreed to by the House of Delegates that will go over to the Senate, hopefully shortly, and be agreed upon so that we can convene this kind of work group of multiple interested parties, including the farm community.
The whole question of reporting, let me start there. The three kind of issues here seems that have been addressed in this debate, and I think they are important. Let's start the question of reporting.
You know, we're very fortunate in our committee, in the environmental committee on the House side, to have Delegate Otto from the Eastern Shore as one of our members.
I know Delegate
and
Otto.
Delegate Otto himself, of course, you know, he's our fertilizer guy.
Right.
And as Charles has explained several times to the committee and to others, there already is collection of data information. There already is a requirement to keep records and to keep much of the information that they were asking or to begin with, but it's kept in a format that is unique to each of the industry or unique to the farmer as to what he's putting on his property or unique to the distributor as to who he's selling things to and what amounts and where, you know, where the fertilizers or where the applications are going. And so there was this sense that they're doing this if there's a question about a particular user or a particular application someplace, that information was accessible for asking for it. What we didn't want was someone to take the reporting information and to sort of synthesize into a problem that didn't exist. So,
what do you mean by a problem that doesn't exist?
Oh, so, for example, in communicating or having an opportunity to talk with one of the proponents of Delegate Lafferty's bill, I asked the following question. I said, so an assumption is made that there's we were talking a variety of different things. We were talking cancers, we were talking just illnesses, we were talking about water quality. in a particular area, and you're trying to figure out why this particular illness or this particular watershed seems to have a problem. So somebody hands you data that says, oh, look, we're using this fertilizer over on these five farms, and automatically they jump to, well, it's those five farms that are creating the problem then. So we didn't want there to be that where they have the ends without having to go in and look themselves for the means. It's a problem that might not present itself. In other words, the farms may have absolutely nothing to do with, an increased phosphorus or a fish kill that's taking place or the fact that there's an increased level of bacteria in a particular area may have absolutely nothing to do with the farms. But if we present them with, look at the particular fertilizers being used by this farm, it's very easy for someone to say, oh, yeah, that must be the cause. And then you find yourself back in a Hudson situation. The Eastern Shore is very concerned that they will find themselves routinely in that same litigation posture, because nobody is – it's one thing if there was a guarantee that the idea was to research the information. If, in fact, there turned out to be some issue with a particular type of a fertilizer, or if it turned out that there was a pesticide that was being used that's having a negative ag effect, the opportunity to modify what you're using or to perhaps it might have resulted in a ban on a particular pesticide, that would be fine. But I think we have seen that the area has become so litigious, both in watershed groups that will sue or environmental groups that will sue and point their fingers at somebody because they were handed some data that says, this could be the problem.
I would like to make one clarification. It's correct that Delegate Otto has pointed out that there is data. At the same time, it's not obtainable from others outside of the Department of Agriculture. They mean any commercial or individual applicator has to maintain records, as I stated right. earlier, but that's not available. If I went and knocked on a farmer's door and said, well, I'm interested in what pesticides you've applied to your property, or I called up a local pest control company and asked them the same question, they have absolutely no obligation, and I really have no right to have access to that information. So knowing what may have been applied in any given area becomes the question. It's not a fertilizer issue. We've addressed that previously. It's really the chemical combinations or chemicals that are in the various pesticides. I don't claim to be a scientist, so whether or not a particular chemical could be ruled in or ruled out from causation of a fish kill or a excessive number of cancer findings in a particular cluster is really what this can help us identify. While I respect certainly many on the Eastern Shore being concerned about that, that's one of my concerns as well. How do we best protect the individuals? And this, again, is not intended to be a witch hunt or in any respects going after individuals, but to find out if there are particular applications or particular chemicals being applied that have an impact that's not intended, just as we've seen over the decades as we've gotten more and more knowledgeable about chemicals.
Well, let me ask you both this question. I mean, I think this is clearly a serious issue for all parties. One of the things that I, in our original conversations about the Pesticide Information Act, was that that there were a lot of scientists, researchers, NIH and Hopkins and other places, EPA, were saying, look, we see this growing body of evidence that pesticide exposure, and in some cases, some scientists argue, in even minuscule amounts can really harm people, especially children, the issue of endocrine disruptors and how it affects hormones and some people hypothesizing neurological disorders as well, ADHD, things like that. So and that's the research that's going on. So the question is, if people think that scientists think there may be a link between pesticides and not just the pesticides we're using on farms, which I'll get to in a minute, or the lawn services, but that Joe and Sally homeowner use on their lawns as well. If this could be contributing to this almost exponential growth in certain disorders in our country, then how do we get to the bottom of it? I mean, what is the way we begin to understand what's being used and where it's being used without the threat of suing every small farmer or medium-sized or large farmer anywhere in the state?
So I think you hit the nail on the head. That's actually the reason that, at least in my opinion, because ultimately I supported the work group and I voted in favor.
You supported the what?
I supported and I voted in favor of the revised bill that resulted in the work group as opposed to the Reporting Act, because I think the points that you just brought up are very legitimate. One of the individuals who testified before our committee owned a daycare, and she was very concerned about the ultimate effect of having to worry about what's used on her property. And I think it was Delegate McMillan who said, you know, he remembers sending his own son to a daycare, and the child, I don't know, picked up a tick. And so the question, of course, then goes to the greater issue of Lyme disease. And if certain pesticides are known for their ability to reduce, you know, the tick population, for example, well, one would suggest that's a good pesticide. Well, if that same pesticide, though, has 10 adverse effects on children. I mean, we're talking about daycare settings, and that probably was the one I think that hit most of us. The daycare setting where the kids are playing outside and they're playing in the dirt, and of course they get dirty. And as I think most parents would say, you know, they know that sometime during their child's lifetime they probably, you know, ate a little bit of dirt. If that dirt is,
if they're lucky,
you know, contaminated, what would be the negative effect on the children? And trying to balance that out. But so that ends up being, I think, the issue is how do you balance that knowledge by the scientists, the NIHs, the University of Maryland, how do you balance the desire to, it might be to outlaw a particular pesticide, or it might be to modify or to prevent a particular chemical in a pesticide. How do you balance that need, the scientific need, from the person who says, my child has ADHD, and I just absolutely know it's because they went to, you know, daycare ABC, and their pesticide they were using on their lawn is what did it.
So
so that's the balance, and we were unable to really get to a satisfactory, at least in my opinion, a satisfactory resolution to that piece.
Well, Delegate Laffer, let me make sure jump in here. I mean, how do we get to that point? I mean, I think that the information, it would seem, about where pesticides are coming from, ever since we started with DDT, and we said it was going to be the boon for our country, and we saw what it did, but we cannot get this information. So how do we get this information? What is the way? I mean, clearly you said you're going to end up with a working group on this, but what does that mean? How do you get to the heart of what pesticides are doing to not just the land, but to all of us?
Well, I don't disagree with Delegate Vitale's assessment, but my point has been since the beginning that if we don't have a way of gathering the data, collecting the data in a broad way, then we're not going to be able to make the kind of assessments and either rule in or rule out the kind of things that you were just saying, Mark. The kind of problems that public health experts have raised, the kind of questions that the EPA and U.S. Geological Survey raised about the lack of data for monitoring or to even understand some of the sublethal effects on individuals or on the environment can't really be identified unless we have a central collection point. Or if you're somehow evaluating it by county or some larger area to see what the collective impacts may be. Again, I'm sensitive to at least two other things. One is how do we look at the rights of privacy? And secondly is what, if any, is the contribution from the homeowner and from the individual who is not licensed or registered with the state,
but certainly has access to many of these same chemical compounds and is applying them. That has been an issue that some of the professionals have raised, is that you have a large number of individuals who can go to their go to the hardware store and buy something and put it down without any training or knowledge as to how it's being applied. And we've seen similar questions raised, as you point out, with DDT and other chemicals over time. Certainly have seen it with fertilizers that have been applied by individuals. And with increasing research, and again, having the data is going to be critical to that research, I believe when we start to get there, it's not going to be a short term, because even if the data were available tomorrow, as we all know, scientists are going to take a while to dissect it and determine what, if any, impact these particular chemicals may have.
So one of the things, I mean, I think this is, you know, this is one of the things that, well, a couple of things, quick things before I let you both go. One of the kind of weaknesses some people argued about this bill, Delegate Lafferty, was the fact that it didn't include us being those of us who would use chemicals on our lawns, which is a huge factor in this. Not that every homeowner can kind of fill out a form and say, I'm doing this for my home and put it in with his or her taxes, but from the point of purchase, perhaps, to know where these chemicals are going. I mean, that's a factor that was left out of this as well, which is what some farmers were saying to me in the beginning. Why is it always just us?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So Delegate Lafferty, should it be more encompassing if we're really going to get to the heart of what these pesticides are doing to not just our environment and our earth, but to also to us?
I don't disagree that makes sense. And it's not just the farmers, it's the other commercial professional applicators who are currently registered with the state that made a logical starting point, at least in my mind, so that we know from the Department of Agriculture who in fact is registered. Now, we also know there's a registry of manufacturers who are bringing products into the state. And looking at, you said, Mark, that point of distribution, I think makes a lot of sense. And if we can figure out a way of getting to that, that doesn't mean that I'm up just because I buy it at, you know, a particular store that's near my house. You know, I don't know. Or Delegate Vitale happens to be in my neighborhood and decides she's going to buy the material and take it someplace else. I guess we can look at that, and I hope that the work group, in fact, takes that in under consideration. And that's, in fact, one of their charges. See if we can get a broader picture, since, as you point out, farmers and others are concerned that they're being unfairly examined or targeted, when, again, that was not the intention.
Well, what we'll do is we look forward to you. Are you both going to be on this working group, by the way?
Have no idea how that speaker's going to.
Who makes
we
that?
Don't know who they'll get appointed to. It is a broad swath of people. I think that the delegate did a great job on the front end of coming up with not only members of the House or requesting members of the House and members of the Senate, but certainly the various Maryland state agencies and the Pesticide Advisory Committees, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, the Farm Bureau. We thought it was important to make sure that you had in addition to the Farm Bureau, that you had a representative farmer on the panel, and so they've agreed to do that. So we amended the bill to include that. Health experts. I do think it's important that one of, at least from my perspective, one of the most important pieces that came out of the modification from the Information Act to the work group was just as the delegate had just said, in response to the farming community's concern that, look, you're always looking at the farmers, you're never looking at the homeowners, you're never looking at the retailers, is there's a very specific charge in the responsibility of this work group to determine whether or not it is feasible to gather data from the retailers and the homeowners. And if that's the case, what are they going to do with that information once they get it? How can you use it? I see the work group more as an opportunity to protect those that need to be protected in terms of the privacy on the reporting side, but at the same time allowing the information to go to the scientific community so they can, you know, really study the effects of the different chemicals and the different compounds. So it gives a chance for a variety of different stakeholders that maybe otherwise thought they were shut out of the process.
You just heard our conversation with Delegate Kathleen Vitale of Anne Arundel County and Delegate Steve Lafferty of Baltimore County. We'll continue to file this bill in the coming weeks before the end of the session. And now, a part of Soundbites that's quickly becoming your favorite, with a great new recipe just in time for Easter. One of my producers, Mark Gunnery, visited Laila El Haddad in her kitchen in Columbia, Maryland. She's the co-author of a book called The Gaza Kitchen, a great new cookbook that shares traditional Palestinian recipes. And here she is with an Easter recipe.
In the book, we feature kaik, which are date-stuffed rings that are variations of which are popular throughout the Middle East, but particularly in Gaza, which is famous for its date palms in the central Gaza Strip. There are exceptionally sweet red dates growing there in an area called Deir el-Balah, otherwise known as the Monastery of Dates. This particular recipe is very popular for both the Easter and the Muslim Eid holidays. You take equal parts of all-purpose flour and whole wheat flour. So we suggest 2.5 cups of each, 1.5 cups of semolina, 2 cups of olive oil, 1/2 cup of orange blossom or rose water, which you can find in most Middle Eastern markets, 1 tablespoon of yeast, 2 tablespoons of ground anise seed, 1 teaspoon of mahlab, which is the crushed seed of a dried sour cherry pit. And again, you can find that in Middle Eastern or Indian grocers. 1 tablespoon of black seed or nigella seed, and 1 teaspoon of toasted sesame seeds. That is the basic mixture which you would want to mix together and then allow to rise for about an hour or two. And then you would make little balls out of the dough, roll the balls into logs, make a small indentation, and stuff that little log with the date filling, which is 2 pounds of date paste. Again, you could find that in Middle Eastern grocers. 2 teaspoons of ground cinnamon, 1 teaspoon of ground cardamom, 1/2 teaspoon of ground nutmeg, 1/4 teaspoon of ground cloves, and 2 tablespoons of softened butter, just to kind of bind all of that together. Mix that well, and then again, you would maybe form little logs out of that date filling to make it a little easier. Stick that into the rolled-out dough log and kind of roll the whole thing together and then close it, pinch it with your pinky. Bake that for about 20 minutes or so, a little bit longer if you want a crispier date cookie. On about 400 degrees, and serve it with tea infused with sage leaves, a very traditional Palestinian tea. Batches of these are ordinarily made on Easter and distributed to friends and family.
Thank you, Laila Haddad, for that recipe, and please check out her book, The Gaza Kitchen, for more delicious recipes. That's all we have time for this week on Soundbites, and I'd like to thank all of our guests, Tim Wheeler, Kim Coble, Josh Tolkien, Delegate Kathleen Vitale, Delegate Stephen Lafferty, and Laila El Haddad. For comments on this episode and to hear the podcast of this episode or any of our past shows, visit ondelmarva.org. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner and like us on Facebook, Soundbites, exploring the future of our food system. Until next week, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. What if you're struggling with your mortgage? The state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's national foreclosure settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555.